Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Affirming churches will sit back and watch queer people lose their rights and have to flee from dangerous situations because they thought they did enough by allowing queer people to show up.
Hi, I'm Chloe Guillo, and you're listening to On God's Campus, Voices from the Queer Underground, a podcast about white Christian supremacy and being queer on the most conservative campuses in the country. Think of me as your guide and translator as we explore the carefully constructed subculture of religious education. Joining me are co-hosts Paul Carlo Southwick, our resident legal expert and historian, and Aaron Green, our biblical scholar. What you will find here is a roadmap to change from the underbelly of the church's best-kept secrets.
Hey, friends. Today we have an incredibly special guest on our podcast. We'd like to introduce y'all to Kaylee Hargrove. Kaylee is a writer, theologian, ordained minister, and director of digital outreach for the Center for Prophetic Imagination. She lives in the greater Atlanta area with her partner and two kids.
Kaylee has been part of LGBTQIA+ activism, bringing awareness of the legalized discrimination queer and trans students face at religious universities. She received her Master of Divinity, emphasizing in biblical studies, from United Theological Seminary of Twin Cities. Welcome to On God's Campus, Kaylee. We're so excited to have you here with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
All right, Kaylee, let's go ahead and get right into it. Something that Paul, Kaylee, and myself all have in common is that we each have attended Christian colleges as LGBTQIA-identified people. We attended those colleges for a variety of reasons, and I think Kaylee and I have a very similar story as to why we decided to go to one. So Kaylee, why don't we start with why going to a Christian or religious college was really important to you?
Like a lot of people, I think, that go to especially seminary, because seminary is like the next step after like going to a college. Like, you at that point when you're working on your master's, like, that is like you're dedicating yourself to something. I went to seminary because I wanted to get a biblical higher education degree, and honestly I did it because I want to teach the Bible, honestly. And that's still something that I desire to do. I went to seminary to get my master's, hoping one day to be a professor at a Christian university or something. I'm sure that we're going to get into that. That's a much more complicated thing for somebody like me to be able to break into at this point. That's why I went to seminary and to Bible colleges, because I wanted to go into a professional ministry, professional Christian education type of field.
And I did the same thing, Kaylee. I wanted to go to a school where I could have a biblical studies education or theological education specifically. Mm-hmm. And I know that the only options for us are private religious colleges at that point, right?
Yeah.
so we don't really have the option of going to a secular school when it comes to, I mean, there's a difference between religious studies and theological education and biblical studies education. Mm-hmm. So that's my part of our experience, I think.
Maybe for a layperson like myself, could you explain just a little bit, like, what's the difference between religious studies and biblical studies? Because I think a lot of people might not know.
Yeah, Kaylee, do you want to go for that one?
So, I mean, so especially for me, because I come from the independent Christian church, which is, it's technically non-denominational, but it's its own thing. Like, it's kind of like saying Calvary Chapel is non-denominational, but it's, you know, it's a denomination. And that, like, that was my tradition. So I went to independent Christian church in colleges. I went to an undergrad at Boise Bible College and then decided to go to Lincoln Christian University because that was, well, at the time, there was really only two seminaries that offered master's programs within my tradition. And one was Lincoln Christian University. The other one was Cincinnati Christian University. Cincinnati ended up closing its doors like a couple years later. So even if I had tried to go to Cincinnati, I wouldn't have even been able to finish. So that's kind of the difference, right? So if you go to a seminary like Chicago, like at University of Chicago, right, you're going to get like an overview of different traditions. You're going to get an understanding of theology and stuff, but you're not going to get that like the teaching within your tradition and like that support, honestly. And that's a big thing, is like having the support of the tradition that you are coming from and hoping to go into and work within. Like, your relationship with a higher education institute is actually really important to like developing connections, developing like respectability within the tradition. It's a lot more than just like going and learning about religion. It's going and learning how to be a like minister or something within your own specific tradition. And this is why there's like United Methodist Church universities and seminaries, and you know, there's Lutheran seminaries. Like every tradition has their own their own higher education that is focused within their tradition, and that's really kind of the big big difference. Is it's not just learning about religion or theology or the development. It's actually like learning to be part of a tradition that you have been a part of for honestly like most of your life.
And Kaylee, we're coming at you from Portland, Oregon. Did you grow up in Oregon or live here for a bit?
Yeah, actually, I grew up. I grew up the first 18 years of my life in Oregon, but not in Portland. I grew up in 7 miles from California and on the coast, in a little town called Brookings, Oregon.
Oh, it's beautiful down there.
It is. I didn't appreciate it when I was living there. And now I regret not taking advantage of living both on the ocean and mountains. So.
And is that where you first were introduced to your religious tradition?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the independent Christian church and went to the same church. I was born in Klamath Falls, Oregon, but we moved to Brookings when I was a year old. So 17 years of my upbringing was the same church, an independent Christian church, that and that was my tradition. Like, I grew up in it the whole time. So when I say I grew up in the independent Christian church, like, it was everything growing up and even after I graduated high school.
So obviously there's been an evolution in your faith and understanding of that, like, over the years, I would imagine. How do you currently describe your faith or religious beliefs now?
So I still identify as Christian. And it, even though a lot of people say that I'm not, and the way that I, give me 1 second to formulate my thoughts.
It's totally fine.
Yeah. So like a big buzzword right now is deconstruction, right? And we talk about like growing up as evangelical, which the Independent Christian Church is a evangelical, somewhat fundamentalist tradition. But like we talk about growing up in evangelicalism and then deconstructing and becoming something else. But I feel like that doesn't necessarily describe like my process, because I don't feel like I tore down any of my beliefs. It was more like, honestly, religion is, or Christianity is the thing that I love to study. It's a hobby of mine. It's something I actually do in my free time. And so for me, it wasn't so much like deconstructing. It was more of like jumping in and studying like what there is to know. And so like there's different people that I studied that like opened my eyes to probably better understandings of different things. So like John Walton, who is the professor of Old Testament at Wheaton.
Yes, like, I've read some Waltonian books.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I agree with a lot of what he says, not everything anymore, but like he still has, even though he's like a conservative Bible scholar, like he actually understands the fact that that Hebrew text is actually like in a genre and isn't meant to be taken like necessarily as literally as what we're told to take it. And really like getting an understanding of how ancient documents are meant to be understood. Like they aren't meant to be taken literal. They're meant to be taken as wisdom to be reflected on. They're meant to be understood as poetic, and like understanding that, being a linguist, I was a linguist in the military for 9 years and learning a Southern Asian language and how linguistic psychology actually affects the way that we understand ideas and communicate, and how that plays into like the development of ancient texts. Like the more that I learned about it, it was like the more that I came to understand like a lot of this stuff that I was being taught in evangelical circles just didn't hold up anymore. And it's like to the point where like even using like very conservative hermeneutics and exegesis, like I became affirming because I followed conservative hermeneutics. And I mean, that's kind of the interesting part of it, is like even using the same biblical studies that like conservative universities are teaching, you can still become affirming. Like it's there. It's actually, you have to go out of your way to not be affirming. And that's actually not an accurate way to describe it. Cause honestly, it's, we are given such a cultural context of unaffirming theology and ideologies that to use a conservative language, we're groomed to be non-affirming of queer people. Like, that's just how it is. Like we are brought into a world where the waters that we're swimming in are intentionally unaffirming, and so like we don't even recognize the fact that we are taking on an ideology because it's been there the whole time. And like that's one of the most like annoying things about unaffirming religious spaces, is like the complete lack of understanding that what they take as like an innate understanding of gender, like that isn't actually true. That is given to us. If we look at other cultures, that it doesn't hold up. Heteronormativity is not a universal experience. But
right.
We act like it is.
It's clear, like, in the way that you speak and how you articulate your expertise, that you're so passionate about the text, about interpretation, about, you know, the truth coming out to folks about the biblical text. So based on your expertise, what are the most common myths surrounding especially trans people and the Bible or within Christianity itself?
I mean, the biggest one is that cis normativity, the idea that people are generally cisgender is not, it's not a universal experience, and it's not even the experience of the Bible.
Right.
And like, we've talked about this on an Instagram live, between you and me. So people can go watch that, also, you know,
this
put
is
in a
true.
Little plug.
It's on the Reap, on the Reap channel on Instagram.
Yeah.
And it's also at Prophetic Imagination too on Instagram.
And I think we got it on our YouTube as well. But just to like jump into it, like, oh, sorry, I cut you off, didn't I?
No, please go. Like, I was just gonna ask, like, can you bust some of those myths for us? Like, what are the most common, or what are the ones that you are most drawn to about those particular ideologies that are disseminated that are untrue about the trans community when it comes to the Bible?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest one is the idea that a gender binary is like part of scripture. And really, we only get that in that idea in one place, which is Genesis 1. And then it's also repeated in, what is it, Genesis 5 or 6, right before Noah's story, where the idea of humanity being made in the image of God, it's repeated.
Right.
Anyways, that's where it comes from, right? But the problem is that holding to a strict gender binary, because there is a verse that says that God made humanity male and female, it, in order to understand that as a fixed binary, you have to read that single passage out of context. So like, we understand that there are parts of creation in the creation order of Genesis 1 that don't fit into exclusive fixed categories. Like, algae exists, right? If you read Genesis 1, there's not a single place in which algae should exist. It's a plant that lives in the water. According to Genesis 1, plants only sprout out of the ground, right? But they exist living in water. There are frogs who start their life in water, but then they move on land, or, you know, in trees. There are mosquitoes that start in water, but then are in the sky and would count as, I don't know, what, creatures of the sky, which isn't specific to birds, but, you know, whatever. You know, there's emus that are birds that don't fly. So they don't really have a category. So they're either part of the creatures of the air, or they're part of the beasts of the ground. But like later on, like a few millennia later, like we turn them into cattle. So now they don't have an original category, but we've forced them into a new category. Are emu farmers sinful because they've done that? Probably not. And then there's like black holes, which nobody had an idea of whenever this was written, but they exist. And so there are all of these things within our universe that we can look and see don't fit creation categories. And we're like, oh, those are okay, because they, like, obviously these categories aren't meant to be like exclusive. And then we get to gender and we're like, oh, but these ones are. So like the only way that we can get to a gender binary in Genesis 1 is to actually read that one verse out of context of the entire passage, which, by the way, is like against exegesis class, like day one. Like, you're going to fail the class if you're doing this, right?
Right.
And
yeah,
like, this is basic conservative exegesis is you got to read the entire passage like consistently. If you're not, then you're actually like, you're not doing a good job. You're twisting scripture is what you're actually doing.
Right.
So yeah, like the entire idea that that there's a gender binary comes from a really bad interpretation of Genesis 1. But then on top of that, there are in fact gender expansive people within the Bible. Like Joseph is this person that is loved more than Israel's sons. A lot of times they'll add the word other sons in the passage in the English translation, but it's not there. Like in Hebrew, it literally says Israel loved Joseph more than his sons.
Right. Yeah, that it's interesting that you talk about that with Joseph too, because I wrote a paper my last semester in seminary before I graduated about how Ruth was non-binary. And she is also compared to worth more than seven sons. So there's obviously that clear connection of a connection to masculinity for her, you know, and a connection to filling what are traditionally male roles in the biblical text. So I love that you're finding and seeing these parts of the text, especially with Joseph, that are clearly pointing towards trans characters in the Bible.
And Joseph, like Joseph is so clearly gender expansive that the only way to miss it is to like intentionally miss it, which we have an intentional culture that tries to force gender binaries so that even if individuals aren't intentionally missing it, like it is an intentional misunderstanding by our culture. But Joseph, like the clothing that Joseph is given, and I'm going to keep using Joseph. I know that some people, when they talk about this, will change their name to Josephine or something. I'm just going to keep using Joseph because that's just the only name that's actually given. And let's be honest, a name doesn't determine your gender. So I think using Joseph is fine. Joseph is given a garment that is not under, like, we don't know what it means exactly. And we don't exactly know what it looks like, but it is in fact defined. It's defined in 2 Samuel 13, whenever Tamar is wearing the same thing. And the author of that passage is like, oh, hey, people probably don't know what this is, so I'm going to define it for you. This is the garments worn by the virgin daughters of past rulers. A lot of times it gets translated as kings, but the word malek really just means ruler. It doesn't necessarily mean king because it can mean like a local, like area ruler. Anyways, that's a little linguistics for that.
No, it's okay. It's clear that you are a Bible wizard. So let's just put that out there right now.
So the literal garments that Joseph is given, biblically defined, is the garments worn by virgin daughters. So like you have to go outside of, you know, conservative biblical translation to translate it as anything else. Like we're taught whenever we learn like in first semester Hebrew class, we're taught, hey, if you don't know what this word is and the meaning is like unknown, you can look how it's used elsewhere and maybe you can figure out what it means based off context. Well, it's used one other place, and instead of just using context to figure it out, it's literally defined. So the only way to interpret what Joseph is wearing as something else is to break like conservative translation rules, which we do, because Because that's what we do. We can't have something outside of cis normativity, right?
Right, well, we have to break those rules, or we have to break those norms. Not, I shouldn't say rules, but what's normative, in order for our communities to survive.
I think that's one of the things, like, why there's so much push against recognizing queerness in the text, is because it really does challenge a lot of fundamental understandings. Like, whenever I say that it's a bad translation, it's not just I'm challenging the translation, it's the fact that I'm challenging the entire worldview that says that it can't be the translation. And that makes people really mad.
Oh, I love that, though. I love that so much.
Yeah, Kaylee, I was going to kind of jump in with a theology and the law question. Since, Aaron's the biblical scholar, I'm the legal scholar, and you are right in the middle of both, because you're a plaintiff in our Hunter versus U.S. Department of Education case, and you filed a Title IX complaint against Lincoln Christian University because they denied you admission for being trans. And I just wanted to ask you about some of what they said when the school requested a religious exemption from Title IX, which would allow them to take federal money while discriminating against you. And I just want to read how they are justifying it from their belief system and what response you might have to that. As the person who got expelled or denied admission, and also as a biblical scholar in this tradition. So here's what Lincoln Christian said to justify their ability to discriminate you based on their biblical beliefs. They say, gender is defined as a person's physical condition as male or female at birth. Gender modification or medical procedures to become transgender are considered sexual immorality. And then they say a biblical worldview does not support an elected transgender lifestyle. Now, I want to acknowledge they don't cite any scriptures in this part, okay? They do cite scripture, but not regarding gender identity or being trans. So I'd just like kind of your reaction or how you would respond to that as the person expelled by this belief system and as a biblical scholar in this tradition.
Yeah. So the first thing is that's like, they don't even understand modern usage of language because the way they frame it is just completely devoid of reality because people like to become transgender is the like, nobody understands trans identities in that way. A person is trans before they do anything medical, right? So to them, to say that a person becomes transgender, just first of all, like shows how much they're actually devoid of like reality around them. But from like a theological perspective, especially within this tradition is supposed to be inherently non-creedal. It is not supposed to have a set of beliefs that holds it together. What is supposed to hold it together is a unified acceptance of Jesus. That's it. So the fact that they are defining what is sexually immoral, which by the way is a complete misunderstanding of sexual immorality as it's talked about in the Bible, and like even in Greek class that I took, we looked at the words that are translated for sexual immorality. Like the people like teaching in this school don't understand sexual immorality as it's used in the Bible to include trans people. They don't necessarily think that it's okay to be trans, but they do understand that like, biblically speaking, it doesn't include being trans. So, like, they have to go against what they're teaching. They have to go against their entire tradition in order to come to this conclusion, which to me is completely baffling on the legal level, because on the legal level, you're supposed to like show that this is part of your tradition, that is part of your beliefs. Well, they actually have to break from their tradition to have this standard to exclude people. So to me, it's completely ridiculous, and the fact that that the Department of Education is even listening to their stance is beyond me, because one, it shows that like the Department of Education, honestly, they don't care about beliefs. They're there to make sure that they get a return on their student loan. So it's all about money, and they'll screw over students left and right to get their money. But from like the point of Title IX is to protect students, they're not doing that. They're intentionally not doing that. They are looking at an institution and saying, hey, you are a real person and not this actual real person, and we're gonna like give you religious liberties to intentionally discriminate against people that we have said can't be discriminated against. That way we can keep this money flow going. And that's really what's going on. Like, it's not about religious beliefs. Like, Lincoln Christian University literally made up their stance. It's not a traditional stance. It's the language isn't even like common evangelical language against trans people. Like, it's literally just made up, and the Department of Education doesn't care. And they'll continue to throw students on their bus because they get that payout from student loans, right? Because they get interest off student loans. And if people are still using student loans at a university, like, they're getting that back. And what's like, I didn't have to take out student loans. I was using the GI Bill and it covered it. I got screwed out of some GI Bill benefits because of what happened to me. But if I had taken out student loans, I would have to pay that back with interest. So like, they would literally be making money off of my discrimination. And there's people that were using student loans that are being kicked out of these universities, and they're having to pay back with interest those student loans, even though that they're being expelled when the government has promised to protect them. So like, it's complete, like, the most unethical stance possible. Is like this is the thing that I don't think people understand. Our federal government, like, even under the Biden administration, who will tweet out, hey, trans people, your president has your back. No, shut the fuck up. You don't. Oh, sorry, I don't know
I
if
don't know
this
if
is a
this is a
swearing
swearing
podcast,
podcast. Oh, it is now,
but
Kaylee. Oh yeah, you can do it.
But like, just shut up, because you've done nothing to protect trans people, and you are leading a government that is literally making money off of our discrimination. Like,
Absolutely.
Yeah,
President
Kaylee,
Biden, he is set up.
do you have a microphone in front of you? Because you should just drop
Just
it.
stop it.
Mic drop moment.
But like, this is the reality of the situation. Is we have a federal government that is saying to our face, hey, we're going to protect you while making money off of our discrimination.
Queer, trans, and non-binary students, who are often, younger people. I know you went into seminary as an adult after a military career, but a lot of kids are coming into these schools when they're 17, 18 years old. And the Trevor Project has published studies talking about the mental health impacts on queer youth, but also how a lot of queer youth have really strong attachments to their faith. And so they're stuck in this place of trying to battle between their faith and their identity, and it can be a really scary place. So why do you think it's important for the world to understand that? That some queer, trans, and non-binary people have strong faith beliefs while also having strong identities as queer, trans, or non-binary people?
Yeah, so I think that you kind of highlight two things. One, the fact is queer people, like non-queer people, do generally have an understanding of spirituality in some form, right? And the idea that Christianity is against queerness is completely messed up. Like Jesus said that people would become eunuchs for the kingdom of God. Like eunuchs in the first century were, one, seen as gender expansive. They didn't fit a male role or a female role. So they are literally outside of the gender binary. Also, they were culturally assumed to have sex with both men and women because they couldn't procreate. It was culturally acceptable for them to be bisexual. And Jesus is saying, hey, some of you are going to become eunuchs. Like Jesus literally telling people of the first century, hey, some of you are going to be in the kingdom of God and you're going to be queer. Like it's literally there. But the idea, like there's this narrative that Christianity means conformity to a heteronormative understanding, which doesn't match the world that the Bible was existed in, was written about. Like the fact that we have those standards is not biblical. It's literally a development over 2,000 years to exclude people. We can talk about history all we want. So the fact that we are here today and there's queer people with spirituality, like it's because it actually still speaks to queer people. Like there is stuff to get out of the stories of Jesus, get out of the stories of Joseph, get out of the stories of Ruth. The entirety of the Bible has things to be reflected on, and there's real connection to between people and their spiritual life through this tradition. And to think that isn't happening is, to use Christian terms, it's really blasphemy of the Holy Spirit, you know, the unforgivable sin to say that the Holy Spirit is unable to work in a certain way. Like that's literally like what is talked down about a lot within the Bible, to create these standards that shouldn't apply to everybody. Like Paul writes about that type of stuff all the time. Peter has this experience about things that people thought were unclean, and God's like, no, these are clean. Like there are these stories of like over and over saying, hey, stop putting these expectations on people that aren't meant to be lived up to. And that's like entirely part of the Christian tradition that we've tried to like cover up. But then on top of that, like what you brought up, like the mental health aspect, like I do have a spiritual like faith. I have a faith that falls within the Christian tradition, right? When I went to Lincoln, I took a class on I don't remember the name of it. It was technically a missiology class, so the study of missionary stuff, and we literally read a book on one of the assigned books was on LGBTQ plus people. And in this book, like I had realized I was trans. I hadn't like started transitioning or anything yet, but like that realization was still there. And we read a book that was literally teaching students in the seminary. And also like I'm in this class with people that are going to become military chaplains. So these are the people we're sending into the military to chaplain our armed forces, that is teaching us to call trans women trans men, like to hold on to their assigned gender. It was literally teaching us to intentionally misgender people, and completely gave understandings of like being gay, being trans, that completely ignored the experience of actual people. It's like somebody watching a like 5-minute YouTube video on something and then coming up with an entire ideology to dismiss a large portion of humanity. Like that's
right,
really what it
which
was.
Which happens all the time. Book. Yeah, that's awful.
Yeah, I mean, and so like that was an assigned reading, and we had to talk about it and have discussion on what this book had to say. And the worst part is there were three people in my class. It was an online class. So it was online discussion who revealed that they had same-sex attractions. But they were like, basically they were kind of side B-ish. Like they recognized that they had attraction, but wouldn't like accept themselves as who they are and believe that their attraction was sinful. I guess that's not side B exactly. Because side B will say that the attraction isn't sinful, but acting on it is. But like these other students are like younger than me. They were like probably in their early 20s saying, yeah, I have same-sex attraction and I've been praying to have it taken away and I've been living celibate and all these things. And it's just like, yeah, there is a mental health crisis with queer people in spiritual institutions because we're literally being told that our existence is sinful. Like,
absolutely. And it's so harmful and there's so much shame about it. We've got one more question that we want to ask you that's related to this.
Yes. Okay. And speaking of Bible standards that suck, why do you think purity culture is stupid? Just get into it. Yeah. Why does it harm people in our community?
Yeah. So, yeah, we're going to go over time on this one. All right. We're going to go back all the way to the Victorian period. So for those who don't know, the Victorian period under Queen Victoria, that was really when a lot of purity standards started to be developed. Like Queen Victoria was really big on covering up every part of femininity, right? However, like this idea of wearing revealing clothes was actually a form of highlighting who was creating a hierarchy, essentially, because rich people were able, like rich women that or women part of rich families were able to cover up more than, you know, peasants, right? And peasants were outside. The women had to be more active. They couldn't wear the things like Queen Victoria was able to wear. So then revealing like outfits that revealed any part of a person's like anatomy would be then seen as lower on the hierarchy. Now we take that European understanding of this idea of modesty, right? And we attach it to colonialism. What happens whenever white Europeans go into, say, Africa or the Americas, and they see these people that don't have this modesty standard that was developed by rich European people, and they see these people that aren't dressed in the same way as them? Well, they decided to use that narrative to say that these people are sexually deviant and they don't adhere to modesty. And because of this, they need the Europeans to go like civilize them, right? And so modesty, in fact, became this way of justifying oppression against colonized cultures. It became part of the narrative that people from Africa were sexually deviant, and that justified things like slavery. It justified the narrative that that black men, especially after slavery was done away with, black men were sexually aggressive, and that black women were basically like sirens, right? Like that they would lure men in, and it became this narrative that had been developed over a few centuries, and it was used to further oppression and discrimination against black people. It was used to erase indigenous cultures, because indigenous cultures in what is now the United States had two-spirited people, and that's I get that that's our current word for it, and they had their own words. But the umbrella of two-spirited, it existed, but Europeans tried to erase that culture and force Christianity on indigenous people because they felt that they needed to enforce their idea that Europe had become the peaks of the peak of civilization, and that they needed to civilize other cultures. And so they intentionally tried to erase indigenous people's cultures, especially around queerness, because that didn't fit into their understanding of sexuality. Now, that's super important because, like, control over sexuality gives people control, like, lets there be a hierarchy and lets people control others who don't live up to that standard. And that, so this is also like this becomes a means for basically white Christian supremacists to force a narrative on anyone that looks different than them because they're able to control like the world understanding of sexuality and stuff, and be able to create a hierarchy off of sexuality. Not let like, when we talk about this, it is all about control. It is an abusive structure that doesn't allow for consent. It doesn't allow for, I mean, honestly, it doesn't allow for men to actually have a healthy understanding of a woman's sexuality or a non-binary person's sexuality. It places it essentially places white men at the top as this not as the non-sexual like entity, and the further that you get from a white cishet male, the more sexually deviant people are seen within our culture, and that was developed over centuries. And so like and so it has become a means of control.
All right, now we're going to do a portion of the podcast where we ask you a question specifically from an LGBTQIA student who has attended a religious college, and it's called Chloe's Corner.
I see a lot of Gen Z leaving the church or walking away from Christian spaces because of the way Christians have treated queer people. Obviously, there are plenty of churches that are outright hostile to queer communities. But even the churches who are, quote, affirming, often aren't willing to actually put their beliefs into practice to help with systemic change. And that rubs someone like me the wrong way. It feels like pastors are far more comfortable hiding behind their pews than they are marching alongside queer people in the streets. I've heard you explain this as a difference between allyship and solidarity. Can you explain what that means to you and what you believe churches or other organizations should be doing to be in solidarity with queer people?
Yeah, I think that is, I mean, that's honestly the biggest thing right now is we're really kind of stuck with two different types of churches. We got evangelical churches on one side who are, even if there are some that are affirming, like the vast majority of them are not, like 99%. And then there's mainline churches that are affirming at maybe probably like only like 50%. And those are like the liberal progressive type churches. So what we end up having is an entire like structure of Christianity that isn't even that like there isn't even an area where there is a primarily affirming space. But even that, like there's this idea that once a church becomes affirming, like that's the point. Hey Crystal, you're not on mute. No worries. And like that in and of itself is a problem. Affirmation is actually only the first step. Like, great, you'll let a trans person come in and use the bathroom that they want to use. That is actually really helpful because there's churches that wouldn't do that. You let queer people be part of your leadership and be part of the service and all these things. But the problem is, like, you can let queer people in as much as you want. However, you still have to deal with the fact that you might live in a state where queer people aren't accepted. Like, if you're an affirming congregation in, say, Florida, like, there is actually things going on that are making queer people leave your state. And it takes more than just welcoming queer people into your church. Like, it is hard. Like, it is hard to have an open table if your state isn't an open state. So the fact is churches, if you, affirming churches will sit back and watch queer people lose their rights and have to flee from dangerous situations because they thought they did enough by allowing queer people to show up. And that's not enough. If you want to express your understanding of affirmation of God's love for queer people, you're going to have to leave your church walls, and you're going to have to show up at the state capitol, at the nation's capitol, at your local school board, to actually stand up and speak for queer people. Right now, there's so much going on against trans people, especially trans youth, that, like, it's incredibly scary. And the things that are being said are literally things like Nazis said to about queer people. Like, Nazis didn't actually start targeting Jews first. They started with queer people. And that's something that we don't recognize. Like, there is actually an effort to legalize. Yeah, so there's an actual effort right now to, like, legalize essentially a form of cultural genocide against queer people by, like, removing actual history books and not talking about queerness within certain stories because it doesn't fit the heteronormative understanding that a state wants to push. Like, if you are a church that wants to help queer people, you've got to get out there. You've got to speak up. You've got to be that person that fights alongside. Because especially whenever it comes to trans people, like, if it is left up to trans people are not going to win. There is not enough numbers of us. There are not enough voices. There's a lot more money than, let's face it, that's a big thing, is the amount of money that is going into anti-trans legislation. Like, we're not going to win. We need people that say they affirm us and who we are to actually stand up in solidarity and speak up, show up, and be the type of people that are like, hey, if you're going to target my trans sibling or my bisexual sibling, whatever, if you're going to target them, you're also going to target me. And unfortunately, we have a lot of affirming churches that are like, that will sit back because they don't feel that they're in danger. And so they'll do the bare minimum to welcome within their church walls and will let everything happen outside the church that is literally harming queer people and literally taking away our rights.
Kaylee, it has been so amazing having you here. Where can people find you online right now?
Yeah, so mostly everything that I'm doing is through the Center for Prophetic Imagination, which is where I work. And I'm sure that there is a link to that. But yeah, if you see stuff on social media, on our Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Threads, because Threads started like 2 days ago and we're on that now. Center for Prophetic Imagination. Prophetic Imagination on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Prophetic Center on Twitter, but we will probably move away from Twitter. If you see our org posting anything, that's me. So you can reach out to me through that. You can gain some of our other resources. Watch the video that Aaron, Chloe, and I did on Instagram and all that stuff. So yeah, everything I'm doing is through CPI. And yeah, you can find me there.
Kaylee, thank you so much. This experience has been absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to On God's Campus, Voices from the Queer Underground. I'm your narrator, Chloe, alongside co-host Paul Carlo Southwick and Aaron Green. This podcast is a product of the Religious Exemption Accountability Project and is produced by Crystal Cheatham from Our Bible App. Listen next time as On God's Campus examines the lessons history has to teach us about where predominantly white Christian educational institutions and the political machines backing them are taking the country now.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
With Chime Secure Credit Card, you can start improving your credit scores with everyday purchases and regular on-time payments. Get started at chime.com/build.
The Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card is issued by Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Results may vary. See chime.com for details. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.